up, and you're tuning into our super summer programming. I'm Hallelujah.
And I'm Stella. And together, we'll be highlighting the queer community, environmental issues, and upcoming local events.
Stay tuned for interviews, discussion, and music from our collections.
Welcome, welcome. This is CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby is located on the ancestral and stolen territories of the Halkamelem and Squamish-speaking peoples, the lands that they have cared for since time immemorial. Today I'm here with Michelle and Matt from the Climate Equity Action and Resilience Project, also known as CLEAR. So welcome to CJSF's airwaves. We're so glad to have you. Before we get too deep into the interview, can you all just introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Michelle is pointing at me, so I will go first. Yeah, my name is Matt Hume. My pronouns are he, him. My background is as an educator. Once upon a time in another life, I was a public school teacher in Alberta, as well as where I come from, and here in British Columbia in Delta. And I've worked at the University of British Columbia at the Learning Exchange, which is located in Vancouver's downtown Eastside communities for just about 10 years now. I came back to do my master's degree, came across the Learning Exchange, which is a community university hub, and absolutely fell in love with the place. And that's how I got connected to CLEAR and why I get to work with Michelle and my wonderful colleagues working on climate justice within the downtown Eastside communities.
Thanks, Matt. Yes, my name is Michelle Hack-Hepburn. So I work at the Sustainability Hub at the University of British Columbia. And we, along with the Learning Exchange, really brought together a group of different nonprofits and community organizations working in the downtown East Side for the CLEAR project that you wanted to hear about today.
Yes, lovely. And I just wanted to start at the beginning, first of all, of like what led to the creation of the CLEAR project.
Yeah, it's an easy but sad response, which was the heat domes of 2021. It's interesting to kind of reflect back. Michelle kind of mentioned we did a wonderful job of kind of collecting both campus and community organizations. This was all in response to the heat dome. And so the Learning Exchange itself, we have not traditionally considered ourselves a sustainability-focused office. We do literacy-based programs, language literacy, digital literacy for community members. We hadn't really done a lot of work in sustainability before 2021, but really witnessing the disproportionate effect that the heat domes had on unhoused populations, on folks who did not have access to cooling infrastructure, AC, really seeing the negative impact it had on the downtown Eastside communities, we could no longer say, hey, we don't do sustainability. It's not in our wheelhouse. And so we ended up connecting with the wonderful folks at the Sustainability Hub who do sustainability and do a wonderful job in promoting it both on campus and out in community, knowing that they were experts in really what does sustainability look like, how do we merge academic and community-based interests to do this. We had the connections with organizations who, again, themselves may not necessarily consider themselves traditional sustainability organizations. Partners like Working Gear, who are a wonderful CLEAR partner, they take donations of work clothing from, for example, film and television shoots who wrap up here in Vancouver. They have a lot of like work-appropriate clothing that would either just go to the landfill or go somewhere else. They take donations and repurpose those for redistribution at pop-up events in the downtown Eastside community. They really consider themselves employment training and employment preparedness. They do some peer advocacy, but they don't necessarily brand themselves a sustainability organization, but when we really think about it, how much waste are they diverting from landfills every year just by taking these clothing donations? And so a really unique aspect is that we pivoted towards really focusing on sustainability research, sustainability network building with the support of the hub, but we really got this network of organizations who now really are leading into sustainability as how can we embed this into our practice? How can we develop funding models that are really supporting sustainability work along all the other amazing things we already do in with community? And so it's a group of people who came together saying we can no longer pretend like we should not or do not do sustainability in community. We need to pivot. We need to find resources. We need to help support the most vulnerable populations, the folks that we work with every day when it does get really hot or conversely really cold out there. How can we really make sure that we can't just say this is not in our scope anymore because it needs to be in our scope. And that was kind of the origins of the project. It started as a two, three-year pilot with some funding from the McConnell Corporation. They really helped us kick off the very early days of working with peers in the community who were doing sustainability-related work and really wanted to advocate to the city, to funders, to really better support the initiatives that were happening in the community. And that three-year pilot is now well past the 3 years. We're still going. It is an ongoing initiative that has grown and evolved, and we've added new partners along the way. We've had new projects that are coming down the pipe that I'm sure we'll talk about over the next hour. And Michelle came and joined a little bit into the process. What were your experiences when you joined CLEAR?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, CLEAR started really as an initiative that was administered as a joint project from the Learning Exchange and the Sustainability Hub. And really, it was we were able to get started through with support from the McConnell Foundation. And it was really a collaboration that came from the previous senior director of the Sustainability Hub, as well as the current director of the Learning Exchange, who were able to start to bring these people together and start those conversations. And so I came in to help lead some of the administration and the logistics, and I saw and found a group of different organizations, different people working at these different organizations. So at the time, there was Embers Eastside Works, UGM, the Recycling Alternative, Working Gear, as well as Learning Exchange and the Sustainability Hub, all at a table working on different projects, bringing people together, taking action to find those immediate actions that you can take to actually start to address some of the impacts from climate change in the downtown Eastside communities, as well as coming together to strategize about how to address some of the larger systemic issues and think about that long-term strategy of impacting policies and understanding the kinds of research questions and the kinds of applied research work that would need to be done to be able to support those long-term goals. So that's what I saw when I came in. And we were able to actually achieve quite a lot in those first initial years of CLEAR. And as Matt mentioned, we have since added new partners. We've been working to expand the group of organizations that we've been working with. And we can share more about the kinds of activities and the kinds of applied research projects that happened, depending on what you would like to.
Yeah, definitely. We will probably get into that. Yeah, it has definitely been getting more and more severe over time, climate change and global warming. I've heard to it being referred even as like global boiling. And yeah, like it is great to acknowledge like we need to have these immediate like steps to address the climate crisis, but also systemic issues. So I was wondering, what kind of work does CLEAR do in and around the downtown Eastside with both like thinking about systemic things and also the more immediate issues?
So we've done a lot in the early years through Embers Eastside Works, who unfortunately is no longer operating as an organization, but they were able to hire peer workers. So people who live in the downtown Eastside, who they decided and they identified what they needed to do, which was to have these pop-up heating and cooling pop-ups. And so with their support, with also some of the funding and the logistical support that CLEAR was able to provide, they held up these pop-up heating and cooling stations to distribute some of the materials that would actually help people who were unhoused or precariously housed in the most extreme weather over the last couple of years. And then in terms of, and we can talk more, there's some more to share with what kinds of materials that I'm sure Matt will speak to. And then in terms of those long-term strategies, we've also supported, especially through the program called Sustainability Scholars, which is run out of the Sustainability Hub, which is a paid program that provides work opportunities, work integrated learning opportunities for graduate students. And so we were able to have graduate students work with some of our CLEAR community partners to do work to advance the climate resilience work in the downtown Eastside. And a big one that's really important is Unhoused Under Pressure, which is a report that was done with UGM. And it basically shows how the climate crisis is exacerbating these other issues and layered on top of all of the other things that people are struggling with and folks are really struggling with in the downtown east side. So issues like mental health, when your body can't identify its own temperature, then you cannot identify yourself that you need help when it's 35 degrees in your apartment. And then so you can't help get the help that you need. You can't cool yourself down because you don't even realize that you're overheating. So I really being able to lay those out and show how the intersections really come out. Another postdoc who is working at UBC has also done some work with VANDU and with EDGE, so the Eastside Illicit Drinkers.
For education, yeah.
Yeah, for education, they have really advocated, and that's so EDGE researchers who are residents who belong to EDGE in collaboration with this postdoc whose name is Amber Grant working at UBC. They really also identify that they, as illicit drinkers who are consuming alcohol in public spaces, when cops pour that out, their body has a harder time to deal with extreme heat. And when it is so hot outside and they need to consume to be able to avoid DTs, which are withdrawal symptoms from alcohol and really one of the only potentially fatal symptoms of withdrawal from a substance, they would then go to a shaded structure and they really experience the police presence of preventing them from being able to consume alcohol in those spaces. And so they are, as well as being more exposed to dehydration because of drinking, they really need to advocate for alternative solutions of how they're experiencing the climate crisis. And so that's one of the things that CLEAR, through partnerships with graduate students and researchers at universities, are really trying to show some research and data to support some of those advocacy issues that people are raising.
Yeah, and I think Michelle touched on a really important overarching theme of CLEAR, which is we do want to support all of the on-the-ground efforts with research, but research is nothing without action, and we continuously get the feedback. The downtown east side are over-researched communities. They don't have a lot of capacity to contribute to new research initiatives. Folks need to be compensated properly. There's a lot of ethical considerations that need to go into research, and so we're not there to add to the bulk of research without action that's done in and with communities, let alone the downtown east side communities. I think really emphasizing, are there community groups who are already doing some action, like the Side Drinkers group, who are already, they're creating heat diaries on the really hot days. What techniques are they using to stay cool? If there is a dearth of shade and tree canopy in the downtown east side, which we absolutely know there is, it is one of the biggest issues facing the communities, that there is almost no tree canopy, no shade creating structures, not a lot of green spaces for folks. And so hearing directly from those with the lived and living experience of facing the day-to-day of when it does get really hot, how can we kind of translate that to inform climate approaches, climate policy? And if there is research, and there is a dearth of research specifically about climate justice as it relates to the downtown east side communities, there has been some done in the intersection, and Michelle articulated the Unhoused Under Pressure report, which really does look at the intersection between underhousing and how does that really affect folks when it does get really, really hot out. I think, you know, identifying whether we're working with sustainability scholars, UBC students, whether we're working with more advanced researchers. Another example is Dr. Liv Yoon, Rafi Arifin, and their team through the UBC Center for Climate Justice. They, not related to CLEAR, they were doing this work long before CLEAR even assembled, but they were really looking at something called the right to cool. And for me, this is a really wonderful example of how tangible research can be turned into tangible action. They were really advocating the idea that cooling should be approached as a human right. Heating is treated as a human right. There are minimum standards standards for, you know, if your apartment or your SRO is not being heated, it is up to the landlord to provide heating as a basic human decency. There was no maximum heat limit for apartments, condos, or SROs at all in BC. It could get as hot as you needed, and your landlord had no duty to provide air conditioning or mechanical cooling to get that down. Liv Yoon and her team were really advocating, saying this should be approached from a human rights framework. We can't just say should we or shouldn't we. We need to declare the right to cool as a fundamental human right. We need to look at very outdated policies, whether it's city, whether it's province, that are restricting folks from accessing cooling infrastructure, whether that's you're not allowed to have AC in your unit, your landlord is not accommodating that. There are no cool spaces in your building. There are a lot of really, like, a lot of barriers towards just folks being able to cool themselves. And I think sometimes it's easy to say, oh, well, there's like cooling centers. Go to the library, go to, you know, one of the shelters is offering cooling. A lot of folks have mobility issues. They are living in SROs where maybe the elevator isn't working that day. They can't always just mobilize to a cooling space. Often they need cooling resources right at home. And so I think Liv Yoon and their wonderful research, they worked very closely with First United, who we are now working with via the CLEAR project. And they've used some of their housing sites to start opening cool rooms that on the hottest days of the summer, folks can go from within that building. They don't have to travel to a cooling center. They're able to access a cooling space just within their building. I know they're working with SFU and some other folks to just really create pools of resources for folks to get cool in communities when it does get really hot as well. And so I think that, and I want to give props to my wonderful, my colleague, Michelle, who is a New West resident. New West was the first district in all of BC who adopted a kind of a right to cool framework. They got ahead of Vancouver, and they did a wonderful job in Vancouver. Recently actually did pass through City Council, the right to cool movement, and props to City Council for getting that through. That does identify that landlords can be punished for not providing cooling solutions for folks who are renting spaces that are not being mechanically cooled, that are getting really, really hot. And so it was a step in the right direction. I think we don't want to do any research just for the sake of doing research. This is a learning exchange model. I hope this is a UBC and SFU model. Research is really nothing without tangible action. And so we really want to emphasize, if there is climate research that is filling that dearth, we do need climate research to be done in with the Downtown East Side and its residents, the peer researchers there, the folks who are living this on the day-to-day. But it really needs to lead to tangible actions, or we're all wasting everybody's time. And really, for the community to take UBC CLEAR seriously, we need to demonstrate that it's not just talk, that we're not just rallying researchers and folks to just continuously talk about how bad things are and how hot things are. What are we actually doing about it? And seeing the right to cool as an example of, we actually saw some tangible action that came from directly within the Downtown East Side, from folks mobilizing and actually taking the theory, the research, how can we apply this to housing sites in the community, and then bringing it to City Council and saying, this model works, can we do more of this? I think that that's really what CLEAR wants to emphasize. And again, it was not a CLEAR initiated thing. We worked with Liv Yoon to we had a right to cool forum last year. It was the Downtown East Side Beat the Heat Forum. It was in November, so after the really, really hot days of the summer. But we really wanted to get community members, organizers, funders, researchers all together to talk about how can we turn the theory into action. And that was where Liv Yoon did a wonderful presentation about their work. And just a few months later, we actually saw that passed. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I would just add, that is what CLEAR has always tried to do. So CLEAR is really a model about convening people and bringing people together. And it's about connecting some of those university resources, which really includes some excellent high quality researchers, to have community organizations who are often have, especially nonprofits, they have extreme limitations both in time. These are folks and organizations that are working very hard to meet the needs of the Downtown East Side based organizations are meeting the needs of folks in the Downtown East Side. And by adding to that capacity to be able to get people into the same room and to have these conversations and make that connection between research that is already happening to the organizations who are also impacted and need some of those research to advance their own advocacy initiatives. That's really what CLEAR has been from the beginning. Yeah. And that's what we continue to try and do, and make those connections between these different groups of people who are working towards the same goals.
Yeah. That's great. I know both of you mentioned the Unhoused Under Pressure report, and I want to talk a little bit about that. I was wondering if y'all would be able to break down the host of systemic factors that have led residents of the downtown east side to be one of the communities in Vancouver that's most impacted by the climate crisis.
There are so many.
I know. We don't need to, I know it's a big one. We don't need to cover all of them because that would be, you know, a big segment, but...
Well, Matt did mention it's the lack of tree canopy. So it's one of the communities in Vancouver that have the least amount of tree cover. And research shows, and I mean, just your experience shows, if you go for a walk in a place where there is no shade from mature trees versus a place where there is shade from mature trees, you can, your body can feel the temperature difference. And so by not having shade, it is exacerbating this like urban heat island effect, which is that, you know, cement and asphalt get really hot. So that's one example. Matt, do you want to?
Yeah. It's a bunch of impacts all kind of coming together, right? The lack of tree canopy means that there's no kind of escape from the heat. You can't really leave your residence or wherever you are to go find shade somewhere. There's also like SROs and other, you know, housing sites that are not able to cool themselves. Maybe it's not even just a landlord who says, no, you can't have AC. Some of them have windows that don't even properly open to create ventilation, let alone having air conditioning in there. Folks with chronic conditions, folks who have been using substances are already sometimes in a state of dehydration or on Michelle did a great job speaking about how folks are sometimes unable to self-regulate. And so having things like an indoor thermometer, some folks who check on each other during those really hot times, these are some of the supports that the community has kind of developed on their own to kind of cope with this. But it's the intersection of a lot of different factors, under housing and poor quality housing with really poor ventilation. It gets really, really hot, dearth of green space, and then, you know, an overrepresentation of folks who do have struggles with their mental or physical health, who don't have the same coping strategies to deal with heat that, you know, folks outside of the community do. When we kind of create a perfect storm of all of those things together, right? They not only do they intersect, but they start to exacerbate one another. And so, you know, somebody who, like Edge does a wonderful job of really advocating for this. So a good example is in the early days of CLEAR, the city of Vancouver is doing a wonderful job putting together cooling kits that had different cooling supplies. You could buy them at a reduced cost. They were provided to different community organizations and the Learning Exchange, others would distribute these cooling kits. One of the challenges with the kits were wonderful in the city. I really want to applaud the city and the folks who really worked on those kits for putting them together. One of the challenges that we had in distributing the kits is that they kind of came as a package deal, and they were really sometimes meant for indoor cooling. They didn't have a lot of resources that were meant for quick cooling or temporary cooling. The Edge folks that Michelle mentioned, part of their study identified, hey, if we're outside, we don't have access to shade or cooling space, and we've been consuming alcohol, I'm already in a state of dehydration compared to the average person because I've been using or because I've been out in the sun. And so just a bottle of water may not be enough to adequately hydrate me if I'm feeling thirsty or if I'm entering a state of dehydration. The city's cooling kits came with a reusable water bottle, which was great, but Edge advocated saying, hey, electrolytes. Electrolyte powder, the same thing that you find in your Gatorade or those sports drinks, this is much more quickly hydrating and could be used in an emergency situation. They said, this is something that we would like to see added to cooling kits specific to the downtown Eastside context. And this is, I think, a lot of what the work that CLEAR has evolved to do as well, is kind of saying, it's great that some of these resources out there, but we need to adapt them to the downtown east side. They're kind of general use right now, and it's wonderful that they exist and they've benefited a lot of people, but we're not thinking about the most vulnerable populations when we're creating things like infographics or communication materials, and we're creating these cooling kits. They're trying to meet a very broad demand and a very broad audience, and creating those, again, very well-meaning, but sometimes things like electrolytes, like reflective paper for windows of an SRO that you could use to reflect the sunlight out. The average person may not need that because they have AC, but this would work for somebody who can't have mechanical cooling in their unit. These are some of the solutions that we've come up with that either come from really community-involved research or folks just sharing their own lived experience saying, hey, it's nice that this cooling infographic that you know, the province put out says that on a hot day, if I'm feeling warm, I can go window shopping to cool myself down. This is a real example. There are no malls in the downtown side providing bad, like, it's kind of, you know, a little condescending to the community, some of these solutions that are proposed out there. And so I think really making sure that as these resources are generated, as folks do start taking climate change and climate justice seriously, we're making sure that they they are considering the diverse needs of folks who may not have the same accesses or resources that the average person may have. We all need to stay cool. It is a human issue. Climate justice is affecting all of us, but we really need to make sure when we're trying to communicate or create these resources, we're thinking about those who are really impacted in, because of their lived and living experience, because of their housing situation, because of their physical or mental health. And a lot of the work that we're doing, as it evolves, it's really advocating for more supplies and resources that are just curated to the downtown east side and the needs of the residents there.
Yeah, and talking about a little more about the urban heat island that you mentioned, I was personally curious if you think that it might be just like a coincidence that that is what's going on in the downtown east side specifically, or if it's an act of neglect or ignorance by, you know, like urban planners or the city.
So this is a challenging question to answer.
Yeah.
In part because there are historical and ongoing systemic issues that have led to some of the reasons why there is less canopy cover. And I don't want to discount those. Mm-hmm. There are also additional challenges of being able to increase canopy cover, especially in a changing climate. Mm-hmm. So urban trees in particular it is difficult to establish urban trees. And what I think needs to happen in part is to be able to invest in community-led solutions. So, and that's also what we've been hearing from community partners in the downtown east side through CLEAR, is when there are community members who are empowered to find and create the kinds of solutions that they would need to, for example, plant more trees and ensure that they grow. It is a different kind of investment than just an engineering team or a parks and rec team from the city to go and plant a tree. And in times of austerity, and also in times of short cycles, it is harder to always remember the value of these long-term community building and relationship building investments, which is really building up a community and giving them the tools that they need to be able to address and reduce those impacts like the urban heat island. There are also strategies that are not necessarily trees of creating shade structures, and they can offer an immediate response and create shade in the downtown east side. And then you start to encounter some different regulations that can sometimes make it more difficult to be able to adapt quickly to the needs of communities all over Vancouver, not just the downtown east side. But so that's why we need to be able to create these collaborations and enable more collaborations to identify what those barriers are and think about how we can move past them. Why is it challenging to be able to put up a shade structure over a sidewalk? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Michelle, there's kind of two very specific examples I can give of kind of what Michelle's talking about here. So one of the Sustainability Scholar reports that came out, it was by a Sustainability Scholar named Radhika Singh, and it was called DIY, Do-It-Yourself Passive Cooling Techniques for Residents of the Downtown East Side, really looking at housed folks but who didn't have access to mechanical cooling. And she really looked at, like, what are some practical solutions that folks could, like, you know, without applying for a massive funding pool or the government coming in to rescue me, what can I just do in my own space to cool it down? One of the recommendations that came out was actually if you paint the roofs of there's a lot of like tar colored or very dark colored roofs buildings in Vancouver, if you've ever seen it from above. If you paint the roof of a structure white, it lowers the indoor temperature by an average of about, like, I think it's 3 to 4 degrees.
Oh, wow.
Something just simple like that. Like, we all learn about, like, color refraction theory in, like, elementary school, right? It actually, yeah, depending on what color you paint the roof of a building can change. So this actually got some uptick. Some folks were looking at it at Housing BC and the city. One of the engineers, it's always an engineering issue, which was like, like, oh, but if you paint the roof white, it might void the warranty. Like, it's it was a kind of like a very functional, like, we could try that, but it's going to void all of the roofing warranty and all the work that was done. And so there's always kind of like a barrier towards doing it. Same thing, there was a few different places in the world have gotten, there was one specific, I can't remember where out of South America it was from, but there was a group that was knitting literal canopy structures and hanging them between buildings. It was very artistic, very colorful. It was a beautiful way of addressing a dearth of tree canopy, which again is something that we were dealing with here. So we kind of looked into it saying, hey, can we knit these really cool canopy structures? And of course, hanging big things of yarn in between buildings, not the most fire-safe practice, which I totally understand from an engineering standpoint. But I think when you keep running into these barriers of like, oh, you can't because of the warranty, you can't because of this, you do want to talk to folks who are the decision makers or policy makers or folks who work in engineering at the city, for example, who may know a way to work around it or what is permitted. Instead of giving a blanket, we can't do this, is there a way in? Can we pilot something? If we get the right amount of funding and the right people together, the community has these ideas. We have the person power. We could get together a team of people to knit 100 tree canopies if we wanted, right? We just need the right in, the right permission to do so. And so a lot of it is kind of tiptoeing around or navigating these permissions, trying to just get the right person at the city to tell us, like, how can we go about doing this, right? And there's some very wonderful helpers at the city who do help and point us in the right direction, but it gets tricky, right? It seems like there's always a reason not to do it.
I will add that the city, and give credit to the city where credit is due, they are moving forward.